This program was first broadcast on Canterbury's community access radio station Plains FM 96.9 and was made with the assistance of New Zealand On Air.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. These things that are pleasing you can hurt you somehow. Don't you draw the queen of diamonds, boy, she'll beat you.
Hi, and welcome to the Alcoholics Anonymous radio show here on Plains FM 96.9. My name is Raylene and I'm an alcoholic. The purpose of this show is to increase public awareness of Alcoholics Anonymous as an effective means of recovery from the disease of alcoholism. Our show has two parts. First, we'll talk a bit about alcoholism, what it is, and what AA can do to help. Then we'll interview a recovering alcoholic who is an active member of AA. I'm now going to ask our guest to read the AA preamble, which is read at the start of every AA meeting.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organisation or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Thank you. So what is alcoholism? Alcoholism is a disease, not a disgrace. There's no shame in having an illness or a disease. An unusual feature of this disease is that it will do whatever it can to convince you that you do not have it. However, once it has a hold of you, the progression of symptoms is like the classic disease model, and the victim is as helpless as a sufferer of cancer. If you are an alcoholic, you are at the beginning of a long road that usually ends in one of three places: prisons, institutions, or death. If you think this sounds dramatic, we can assure you that our collective experience has shown this to be true. The challenge is to convince the alcoholic to admit that they need help and become willing to seek it. Denial is a major symptom of alcoholism. The alcoholic is often the last one to recognise it and admit that they have it. Our definition of alcoholism is that it is an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. The allergy is the physical aspect of the disease. After having the first drink, the phenomenon of craving develops and we lose control over when we will stop drinking. The old saying is, one is too many and a thousand is never enough. And yet, because of the obsession of the mind, the mental aspect of the disease, the alcoholic is compelled to keep picking up the first drink. This makes us powerless. We often hear from sober alcoholics that many doubted whether life could be fun without alcohol. Fortunately, those same people report that their lives have improved dramatically since they became sober. The 12-step program of recovery, which is discussed at meetings and which is outlined in the Alcoholics Anonymous Big Book, is how we get sober and maintain our sobriety one day at a time. This program has a proven track record of helping otherwise hopeless alcoholics to achieve long-term sobriety and recovery. It has taught us how to enjoy life sober. Okay, for anyone who has just joined us, you're listening to the Alcoholics Anonymous radio show here on Plains FM 96.9. We're just about to interview an AA member who is going to share their experience with alcoholism. So let's meet our guest. Would you like to introduce yourself and give us a quick outline of your who you are?
Okay, my name is Tony. I'm an alcoholic, and I've been sober for 25 years, I kind of got sober when I was 34, 35, so I'm 60 years old. I work in a field which involves education, theatre, academic research, married, happily married for a number of years now, and originally got sober in London, England.
Thank you. And how was your childhood?
That was my childhood. I was kind of well acquainted with, I guess if I'm honest, I was well acquainted with alcohol. My family was a kind of Irish Catholic family who kind of, my father was in the Irish Army, and then he joined the British Army, and then we traveled around quite a lot. And I was acquainted with alcohol, with poverty, the poverty that kind of often attends the drinking of alcohol, and with violence as well. But at the same time, my parents did their best, they weren't really prepared for what life was going to throw to them. I think my father had a drinking problem. It's not my place to say he was an alcoholic. I know that I'm an alcoholic. I do know that when I was very young, in this kind of fairly chaotic environment, I made a vow to myself, I'll never end up like my father, which obviously, in terms of becoming an alcoholic and the up and down nature of that, I obviously did, although I never practiced physical violence. I did on people, I did on objects for some reason, and buildings and climbing buildings. Obviously I was very kind of adept with kind of putting people down verbally as well, simply, I guess, because it made me feel better about the discomfort and the dis-ease that I had in myself, which was part of being an alcoholic.
Yeah, thank you. So when did you start drinking and how did it progress?
I guess I started in my teens, and I was quite kind of bookish. I kind of went away from the chaos and violence in my family to books, to education, and I was tall, so looked older than I was, so I'd go down to the local off license, or as it is here, a bottle shop, and get bottles of cider and sit in my room and write. As I was drinking and writing, I thought, oh my God, this is amazing. And then I wake up the next morning and it wasn't as amazing as I thought it was. But that was part of who I was. And then I guess from early on, I drank to excess, and I would drink to the point of lying on my bed, my head spinning round and vomiting. And the thing was that I this didn't indicate to me that I should stop. This kind of, I don't know where this came from, but it just indicated to me that I should learn how to drink properly. So I kind of, I went to an all-boys grammar school in England, and then that in sixth form changed into a sixth form college, which was co-educational mix. So that brought a whole heap of other issues to the fore in my life. And I remember going into, they had a lecture theatre and a theatre and all kinds of other good facilities, but going in there, having had drinks in the pub at lunchtime and kind of sitting in lectures and physics lecture. I didn't even study physics, but I was sitting in there and my head spinning, and I did a number of things like performance theatre at school, and they're all tied up with shyness, strangely enough, with not feeling comfortable, and but the drink was certainly something that I turned to help that in the early days, because it meant I could, or it felt like I could talk to anybody. The problem was what I said was a load of rubbish because I've been drinking. But there we go.
So how did you drink, socially or alone, binge drinking?
A combination, I guess. I would drink with other people, but it would get to excess pretty quickly. I remember after one, we'd just done a performance. I'd written a play and everybody performed in it, and we went out to celebrate, and we went to the park and we had bottles of this and that, and for some reason I took it into my head that I needed to drink martini. Somebody brought a bottle of martini. So I drank that, but to excess, to the point where I was throwing up and really embarrassing, because all the people I was trying to impress were now looking after me, holding my head up and whatever. And I didn't actually drink martini after that in my drinking, but I did drink other things.
Thanks. So did you ever feel it was a problem, and did you ever try to stop?
As it went on, yes, I did feel it was a problem, and I did try to stop, but that was kind of later on down the line, because, you know, I was drinking, but things were going reasonably well at the same time. Obviously, there were a lot of difficulties that I wasn't even dealing with. When I was 16, my father ran off with, in fact, with a 16-year-old girl, and he started having children with her. At the same time, I got a scholarship into, you know, quite a good university, and we got evicted from the family home. So that kind of crucial point of the age of 16, which is kind of difficult enough at the best of times, was full of kind of fairly watershed moments. So I went off to university, and you know, I was deeply uncomfortable. I didn't even know how uncomfortable I was, you know, I things went reasonably well academically, but I was you know, I was drinking, I was you know, there were a lot of, at that time, there were a lot of drugs around as well. I never really seriously got into that, but I had a lot of friends who smoked a lot of weed. I had acquaintances who, you know, at the college where I was, there was quite a lot of hard drugs as well, which was part of that environment. But it was like, at that time, it was like, oh, this is great, this is poetic, this is whatever. But, you know, it really wasn't. Yeah, it pretty soon turned fairly dark and fairly hopeless.
So what made you realize you needed help? You know, describe your rock bottom.
That came quite a few years later. I'd been working and traveling and involved in various kind of businesses and relationships and creative projects and this and that. And I'd been to France, to Italy, to Turkey, and I'd come back to London, excuse me, where I was staying in a friend's flat, and he was over in Prague at the time, and I was in this kind of crazy relationship, and when that ended, I was quite hurt by that, and I remember the last day of drinking. I kind of came to in this borrowed flat, and there was some drink in the house. There was which I soon finished. There was a bottle of wine, but I put it in my kind of non-compos mentis state. I put it in the freezer, so there was a frozen bottle of wine. So I was holding it out over a bar heat to try and thaw the wine bottle, and that kind of that went. And then, you know, I still hadn't had enough, so I kind of ran into the street, got a taxi, kind of went round London on a Sunday, and for some reason, maybe the taxi driver was trying to rip me off, but there was nowhere open, so I ended up back at a Turkish restaurant near where I lived, and I had to order some food and in order to get the wine, and for whatever reason, that was the end of, that was the last drink that I took. The next day I was sufficiently hungover not to really do anything, but then I do remember the first AA meeting I went to, which was in that area of London, and it was quite a rough meeting. There were a lot of older guys there with long coats tied together with string, and chain smoking, because back then people did smoke, and drinking out of great big bottles of Coca-Cola. So it was like there were a lot of people who were obviously living on the street at that meeting, and it was like, I thought, oh my God, is this what I've ended up? So I went out and did a bit more research or experimentation or drinking, and eventually got back into AA after a couple of weeks. And I remember going to a meeting. It was in a place which at that time was called the City of London Polytechnic. And when I went into the meeting, people went around the room and they kind of introduced themselves by their first name. And I'm like, when it came to me, I said, my name's Tony and I'm not sure. And then everybody did a smile, you know, the AA smile of like whatever, whatever. I remember there was a guy there, and he was giving the chair, the lead sharing in the meeting, and he was saying, "Oh, well, I've just come back from the Houses of Parliament, and I talked about this and this and this, and I've been 10 years sober," and I was thinking, "You poor guy, why do you need to come and tell us that? You know, if you're really living your life, you wouldn't need to live it in AA rooms." That was how my head was thinking at the time. You know, my situation was pretty desperate. I had, become morally, physically, spiritually, financially, in whatever other sense, bankrupt. But there I was, still judging other people to make myself feel better. So after that meeting, a lot of guys came up to me and gave me their phone numbers. And again, I was fairly mad, and I was saying, "Oh my God, it's a secret. It's a secret club or something," you know. So it's like, I kind of shied away and what have you. But, you know, I kept coming back to meetings, and eventually I got to meetings. I for very bad reasons, I was going to meetings in central London, but I thought, I'll go to meetings in Chelsea because the women would be prettier there. That's what I thought at the time. So, which was true. But also, there was a very strong recovery. I didn't know it, but I went to meetings where people really stressed the what was called the joys of recovery. I went to a meeting called the Joys of Recovery, and I went to a meeting called A Vision for You, where I found my sponsor. And again, for really bad reasons, I was told, everybody around me was saying, "Get a sponsor, get a higher power, get on the steps." So, okay, fine. They said, to choose a sponsor, you should look at people in the room and find somebody who has what you want. And I saw this guy, and he was a stockbroker, and he had a Jaguar, and he had loads of good clothes and lots of women around him. I thought, I want some of that. Maybe this sponsor thing, maybe he might give me some money and sponsor me in that way. But in fact, he turned out to be this amazing guy who was the prison liaison officer for England and Wales. So he wasn't giving me money, he was taking me out to prisons. And we were having AA meetings in prisons. So we'd go to Feltham Young Offenders Unit, we went to Brixton Prison. And I saw some pretty hairy stuff in there, because quite often AA wasn't particularly welcome in the prison. Quite often these were remand prisons where, you know, you might be in a meeting one week with a young guy, and the next week you might hear that he'd committed suicide in his cell. And the warders were sometimes taking us in, and they were the worst for wear from alcohol as well. So it was a pretty heavy environment. But the thing was, I don't know if what I did helped any prisoner get sober, but it got and kept me and the people who went in sober. We'd come out of those prisons, and we'd be grateful, we'd be sober, and you know, we'd done our best at doing service. So, you know, I was taken to drunk tanks in Whitechapel, and I did hospital service going on to locked wards in various hospitals in London. And, two of us, and doing 12-step work and going out. And so some fairly rough situations in a big city, high turnover of newcomers. I did phone service at the office in Chelsea as well, which was a bit of it was crazy. The switchboard was constantly lighting up. So it was a really good kind of grounding and recovery, because there was so much to do. So I felt like I was, in a new job.
Right, thank you. So how have you managed to stay sober? You've touched on service, but
sure.
Yeah, so.
I guess in my case, and it's just my experience, I can only share my experience. I had a sponsor back then in London, and the sponsorship, he stressed the importance of working the steps and doing service. And, took me through the steps. And I remember, for example, doing step four. We had a very kind of rigorous groups that I was part of. So I was sitting at a desk in this flat, and I was writing, and I was told to be rigorously honest and thorough inventory. And I kind of did the pages landscape, but I filled 250 pages of these kind of things, so it was very, very thorough. And then I went to my sponsor had a flat in Notting Hill in London, and step five, I would go and read him this amazing, awful document over a period of 3 or 4, 5, 6 weeks. And as I was doing that, it kind of lightened the load. And I remember, having done that, he said, "Okay, now go into the nearby park and just feel the relief," which I had, because it meant that all of that stuff that I thought was so important, all of the resentments I held and the associated behavior, I could in some ways let go of and look people in the eyes and not be kind of looking around the next corner for somebody I might have offended or owe money to or have, you know, caused some kind of trouble to. So there was this amazing kind of sense of relief, as there was with step three as well, the kind of the you know, handing over my will and my life to the care of God as I understood God. So I went through these steps. Of course, being a kind of dramatic person, I thought, okay, well, that's what I'll do for the rest of my life. I'll just be doing AA service, unemployable, whatever. But gradually, I got a sober job, a very small job, which was at a church called St. Martin's in the Field in kind of Trafalgar Square. And my job was to go in there in the evening and light all the candles and usher people into their seats, and you know, while there were classical musical concerts. And that was really interesting. I think I got like £10 every time I did that. And it just really helped me to quieten down. Just forced to sit there and listen to The Four Seasons by Vivaldi over and over and over. It was kind of cool. Then I got a part-time teaching job. Then I got a full-time teaching job. Then I started to travel. Then I came to New Zealand. Then I kind of got one job here. Then I got another job. Then I got married here, then I got residence, then I did a PhD over 7 years, then I've started to write books and articles and blah, blah, blah. So it's a huge change from at the end of my drinking. I couldn't remember words for simple things. I couldn't string a sentence together. So this is just how my recovery has gone. Everybody goes in different ways. This is how, you know, 25 years of recovery has gone for me.
Excellent, thank you. So you've actually just described your life today, but no. You know, how do you feel within yourself today? You know, the changes inside.
Yeah, I guess it's about some bad things or things that I didn't want to happen have also happened in recovery. I was in Wellington working on a play there, and I got this phone call that my mother had died, and that was the thing that I'd feared most. And yeah, it was pretty hard to take, but and my wife came up to see me, but also one of the first things I did was go to a meeting in Wellington. Mm-hmm. And they were really lovely in that meeting, and the people I was working with, because I couldn't get back in time for the funeral, it just wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. So the people I was working with took me to the bay, and they, you know, put flowers in the sea, and they sang Irish songs, and it's pretty good.
Lovely.
It was pretty amazing.
What would you suggest for any listeners that think they may have a drinking problem?
I think if they think they have a drinking problem, my experience would suggest when I thought I had a drinking problem, I had a drinking problem. So the thought of the drinking problem is really kind of not a bad indicator that there is a problem. But and I know it's really hard. I didn't have to phone up to go to AA. I just walked into a meeting because in London there are many, many meetings. All times of the day. And then in Christchurch also there are many, many meetings, and there's also the phone office where you can phone, and you know, people will come out and talk to you. And I think that's the best thing, is to talk to somebody who's been down this road, a road of alcoholism and disease, but also a road of recovery. And pretty soon I think it will become apparent if you have a problem and if AA can help that problem. My experience is that it can. My experience of meeting many, many people is that not everybody wants AA, needs AA, gets AA, but those that do, it is a solution. There is a solution.
AA is described as a spiritual program. What does spirituality mean to you?
Whoa, it has meant all kinds of different things. I mean, I do remember when somebody talk to me about the section in the book where it says God as you understand God, and I'd had some pretty up and down experiences with God being brought up a Catholic, but now I, you know, it constantly changes. I don't understand God. I don't have to understand God. I just have to accept that there is something, that there is a higher power, and I see enough evidence of that in the recovery of people in the rooms, in my own recovery, to you know, to have that deep belief there is something to help us.
Yeah. Thank you. Tony, thank you so much for coming on the show and sharing your story with us.
Thank you.
For our listeners, if you've related to anything that you've heard or would like some more information about Alcoholics Anonymous, you can look us up on the web at www.aa.org.nz or call us on 0800 AA Works. There are 66 meetings a week in Canterbury, so it's likely there's one near you. Join us next week to hear from more AA members sharing their experiences. Our show airs every Monday at 6 p.m. on Plains FM and repeats on a Wednesday at 12:30 p.m. You can find podcasts of all of our past shows on the Plains FM website at plainsfm.org.nz. That brings us to the end of the show. Thank you for listening, and remember, if you want to drink, that's your business, but if you want to stop, we can help. You don't have to do it alone. We will now close the show with the Serenity Prayer, as we do in every AA meeting. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. You've been listening to the Alcoholics Anonymous radio show on Plains FM 96.9.
Desperado, why don't you come to your senses? You've been out riding fences for so long now. Oh, you're a hard one, but I know that you got your reasons. These things that are pleasing.